G'day. It's lovely to have your company with me. Welcome to the Garden Clinic Digs Deeper podcast. I'm Linda Ross, and I'm a landscape architect and garden lover, horticulturist and plants woman, and I love growing all types of plants on the eastern seaboard of Australia in a little coastal town on the central coast. I absolutely love my garden, and it's really nice to have you with me. Today, it's all things geranium, or should I say pelargonium. Absolutely enchanted with pelargoniums dripping out of window boxes right through the northern hemisphere. And growing them in Sydney or in Australia is just as easy. In fact, they grow so much better for us here with our warmer climate. But there are a few tricks of the trade I want to let you know about. So welcome to the Garden Clinic podcast. We go right across Australia talking all sorts of really interesting topics of conversation, but all related to gardening and gardens. And the topic of my podcast today is all things geranium and pelargonium. I've wandered out to the northwest suburbs of Sydney to a little place called Dural, which incidentally was the heart and soul of the garden industry for years and years until all of these new sort of suburbs sprung up. But one of the nurseries that remain is this lovely little geranium cottage nursery. I've been coming here for decades. It's an absolute wonderland of geraniums, and it's brimming with colour at the moment in early spring. So I'm really happy to chat to Reva Dale, the owner of the nursery, to talk all things the Geraniaceae family. We'll learn a little bit about that. I've decided to broaden the podcast just a little bit. So later in the podcast, we're going to chat about wisteria. That's my plant of the week because they've really captured my attention. They're growing over everything at the moment and flowering their heads off. They're rambling over country fences. They're rambling up stone walls. They're dripping over pergolas. There's so much to know about wisteria, not only the common Chinese wisteria that we all sort of know and grow, but some of the more ravishing Japanese wisterias I would like to chat about today, and the American wisteria. So that's my plant of the week coming up a little bit later. Also, I've decided to include a garden hack of the week. This is where I share something really important to me, something that makes gardening easy for me and that makes amazing results in my garden, something that I've done for years and years, that my garden just shines and thrives because of this one hack. So I'm going to share my early spring hack with you today on the show. So keep listening. It's great to have your company with me today on the Garden Clinic Digs Deeper podcast with Linda Ross.
The best garden in the street.
G'day, Graham Ross here. Now, you all know I love my gardening, and we all know that sea salt is simply fantastic for keeping your garden healthy and looking great. But did you know that sea salt reduces transplant shock and dramatically increases the plant's survival rate when they're newly planted? Now, look, it's like an insurance policy for your plants. So when you're planting out your seedlings and new plants in your garden, don't just water them in, sea salt your plants.
Don't forget the sea salt.
What Reva Dale doesn't know about geraniums and pelargoniums isn't worth knowing. She's a minefield of knowledge, and her gorgeous and very popular geranium cottage nursery in Sydney is a hub of activity on weekends with such a wonderful selection of geranium and pelargonium hybrids, a delicious cafe, and homemade jams and jellies to top it all off. I feel so privileged to run our annual geranium workshop here with her, and I always come away with more information about varieties, taking cuttings, care and pruning requirements for this very interesting genus. Considering the changing and warming climate, geraniums thrive in this heat. They love hot and potted spots, window boxes and hanging baskets. And I'm thrilled to welcome Reva Dale to the Garden Clinic Digs Deeper podcast. G'day, Reva.
Hello, Sandra. Sorry, hello, Linda.
I'll answer to anything. I really wanted to talk a little bit about the Geraniaceae family with you because you really have such a wide knowledge of it. But really, in Australia, what we call geraniums really are pelargoniums.
That's right. They're part of the Geraniaceae family, but we do misname them. So we call them geraniums basically because we follow the British.
And they've always called them geraniums.
Yes. In Europe, what we call geraniums are known as pelargoniums.
And it's interesting that pelargoniums came out on the first fleet.
That's right.
didn't they?
They did. It's been recorded that one of the medical officers recorded that today a red geranium flowered in my cabin.
In his cabin. And I think in the early days of the settlement here in Sydney, they would have been used probably as little boundary hedges.
Absolutely. And that the type of geranium is the sort that you see through a lot of the outback or country towns, the big sort of red sprawly ones. And if you go to places like Broken Hill, you'll see enormous examples of them. You know, really tall, huge, strong plants because they've liked the conditions there. But the modern geranium is very, very different to the sort that came out originally.
It is interesting that they're just such a toughie. They really thrive in this heat and the sun. And as you're saying, that a lot of the new generation are all coming from the kind of hybrid factories of Europe.
That's right, particularly from Germany. We import from Germany nearly every year varieties from a company in Dresden, and they have about 60 scientists working on nothing but making new geraniums. And the sales of the geranium family is just enormous in Europe. It's the biggest sales of all plants. And I remember being told once by one of the owners of the company we deal with that in Amsterdam alone they will be selling for at least 4 million geraniums.
It's extraordinary. We just did our workshop today and you told me that in Europe, well, if we're lucky enough, we get a European vacation and we see the billowing colours of geraniums spilling out of window boxes through the Mediterranean, up on the lakes district of Italy, right through the window boxes of every single pub in London. They really are a very popular choice for window boxes, aren't they?
Absolutely. But the interesting thing is, one of the reasons why the plants are so wonderful in Europe is, of course, they're annuals. They die in the winter.
Okay, so why are they so popular?
They're so popular, of course, because they're so wonderful. They look so gorgeous. But in Europe and in England, they're annuals. My sister buys them in the same way as we would buy a petunia out here. She just goes and buys a dozen little pots in tubes and plants them in her garden. And after spring and summer, she just digs them all up and throws them out. And that happens all throughout Europe. Those wonderful window boxes are not there in the winter.
So we are lucky, really, in Australia, because we can perpetually grow geranium pelargoniums right through winter, winter after winter after winter, and really get a huge number of years out of single plants.
Yes, that's right. But one thing that Australians are really, really bad at is because the plants don't die and they've usually got flowers on them, they don't cut them back. And it really is important that you prune your geraniums to keep them in order, to keep them flowering. And also, you know, one of the complaints I hear is that, my flowers aren't so big. You know, they get smaller. Well, they won't do if you cut them and then get, you know, because you regenerate the plant every year. So autumn is about the best time to cut them back. And even if they've got flowers on them, just cut them off. Use the flowers as cut flower inside at the house and know that you're going to get twice as many flowers because you cut them, the parent.
So think of Easter being a good indicator around Easter time to, okay, now I need to just give my pelargoniums a nice big shave, geraniums a nice big cut back. At what percentage should we be doing that?
Well, normally you'd say cut them back to a third of their size. You've got to look at the plant, though, and see how big it is when it starts and where it's growing. I mean, if you've got a great big pot of plants, you don't want to cut it back necessarily to a third of its size if it's going to look odd in the pot. You want to cut it back just enough to allow it to regenerate. But in the gardens, you know, people always say, oh, they've got these big, long, leggy plants. Well, cut them down.
You know, you said that to me, and it's easy said, but not so easy done. I've been really fascinated, and when I've come out here, I always buy an extra scented geranium to add to my collection. And that lovely, spectacular, the best scented geranium on the planet is Mabel Grey, which is just the most citrusy, lemon-scented geranium. Is that just the best one?
Definitely. That's an interesting interesting plant too. It comes from Kenya, and it wasn't discovered until 1960. So it hasn't been around, for gardeners for that long. It's a very, very tough plant, and it grows. It'll grow into a small tree. So what you do is you grow it to a height that you require, and then just chop it. Cut it off and let it and force it to branch.
Okay, so I'm a little bit tentative with that strategy. So what I did is I just sort of pruned half of it back and got that half regenerated and then went and did the other half. Is that cheating?
No, it's not cheating if you like a funny looking plant.
Look, it's so wonderful. I put it near my outdoor bath and I pinch off some and I shove it in the bath and the kids have an outdoor bath every weekend. It's just one of the most wonderful fragrances ever. So I really love that plant. Okay, so let's go back to that care and propagation and then the pinching out that you were telling us about, because really I feel like that's the heart of success of growing geraniums properly. How do we keep them compact? When do we pinch them out? Is it just a matter of doing it as soon as you walk past the geranium, and how far do we pinch?
The secret of growing geraniums is, first of all, very well-drained soil. They don't like wet feet. And to pinch them out is to help to shape them. So how you pinch them out is you look at the stalk, and where you see a bud, you pinch out the growing tip next door to the bud. If you're not quite sure what it is, let the plant grow for a little while until it's an inch, above the bud, and then cut it out or pinch it out. When you pinch it out, that stalk can't grow any further, so it's going to branch out from the sides, and that's how you make them bush up. Modern geraniums have a tendency to be compact, but we don't all have modern geraniums, and there's a lot of old-fashioned things that are very, very well worth having and keeping, and that's the way to get them to look, nice and rounded. And
also, I think some of that energy would then be directed into larger flowers?
Absolutely. Absolutely, yes. They definitely would.
So you get a better-looking bush and you get better and bigger flowers. So win, win, win. All right. When you're pinching out, it's quite a succulent little stem, so not quite the cutting you'd need for cuttings, but when would you take cuttings?
You don't need to have a big long cutting, because if you have a long cutting, you're going to have a long ugly plant when it roots. So the cuttings should really be about, say, three nodes, one node at the top and two. That would be safe for a home gardener. If you've got perfectly sterile conditions, you can make cuttings smaller than that. But look at three nodes. Cut. You've got the top node where the leaf is coming. Then you've got another node. And then the third node, cut below that. Remove all the leaves that you can except the very top. And just leave it. And definitely take off any buds that might be on the little piece. Then you need to get some very friable mix. It's quite a good idea to buy seed setting mix from a nursery and set it in that. You firm it in, water it well, but don't water every day, because otherwise the plant thinks it doesn't have to put down roots. So just water it, depending on the weather, once or twice a week. Put it somewhere where it's not in the sun but nice and bright. And it should root within 3 to 4 weeks. Once it's well rooted and you pot it into a pot or into the garden, leave it for a couple of weeks maybe, and then pinch the top right out again to force it to grow from the bottom.
We were talking about you could put, six little cuttings in the same pot and get them growing like that, and then you might not get 100% success rate, but you're increasing your chance. We were also saying you do that not on a yearly basis, because you don't really want to be holding on to old and haggard geraniums for too long. You can want to be replenishing your display with your newly rooted plants.
Yeah, that's right. You can keep geraniums for an awful long time, but especially if in the pots, they could get root bound. Good idea to keep them looking good is to get a skewer every so often and have a good old dig in the pot, just to aerate it, and a little bit of Osmocote for feed is is good. If you're using, the general rule is if you're using a liquid fertilizer with geraniums, go half strength.
And you've got very interesting observation about using a seaweed product as well, because you think people use too high a concentration of seaweed on their geraniums because they all go glug, glug, or extra glug, and do it too strong.
Yeah, yes, you really have to be careful. Since seaweed products have been popular, I've had an awful lot of people tell me that they've put it on their geraniums and they've died. But you know, home gardeners are shockers because they always pour extra on because they think, oh, good, oh, I'll get the plant will grow quicker and bigger, but it won't. Always follow the instructions. If you follow the instructions, if you're giving your gardener a dose of seaweed product, follow the instructions definitely when you come to geraniums.
You were mentioning that cuttings for geraniums are better taken in April, so let's say Easter, in autumn, great time to take cuttings. Sorry, great time to prune. Can you use those prunings for your main cutting?
Absolutely. In fact, if you're taking cuttings, don't do it on when we have high humidity, otherwise you're likely to get black rot. You take the cuttings when the humidity, especially in Sydney, when the humidity's dropped. So if you're doing pruning at Easter time or you know, that time of the year, that's a good time to do cuttings, and right through until maybe October, November. But it's in the summer, in our middle of our summer, when the humidity's high, just don't do them then.
Okay, so talking about summer and our 45-degree days and geraniums being really, well, a lot of people grow them in pots, and I'd say majority of geranium lovers have them on balconies and window boxes and verandas and, you know, potted culture. There are some fantastic geraniums that do grow in the garden, but I would say the majority are in pots. On those hot days, how often would you be watering, and would you be using black plastic pots for geraniums at that time of year?
No, you've got to be really careful with plastic because it gets terribly hot, whether it's black or dark green or whatever, because they can actually cook the plants. If you've got a plant that's in the garden, it must be in a big pot with a good thick terracotta or something like that, so that it doesn't get boiling hot. If you've got your plants growing in plastic pots, and you want to have them in the garden, a good idea to put them inside another pot so that there's a barrier, you know, for the heat. You need to keep, if it's in a very hot spot in pots, you need to water them more often than you would normally. Maybe in the middle of our summer, you might have to water them every third day, whereas in winter, maybe once a week.
Okay. And just normal rainwater, any water?
Well, most of us aren't able to get... We do. We have rainwater when it rains. but we've got big tanks, but at the moment there's no rainwater in them. But just ordinary water, that's all most of us have.
With that little dose of fluoride and chloride. All right, so just tell me a little bit about what was Queen Victoria's favourite geranium?
Queen Victoria's favourite geranium was called Apple Blossom Rosebud, and it's available quite extensively in Australia now. It's been available in Australia for many years, but it sort of deteriorated a bit, but their fresh stock has been brought in, and it's been absolutely fantastic, and it's a white apple blossom, a white flower with tight sort of rosebud type petals, and it's white, and with a bit of sun on it, it flushes with pink. Very, very pretty.
It does. Perfect name, really, because they do really look like rosebuds.
They do.
All right, another really good one. Can you just tell me, how did Big Red come about? Because it's really a huge seller, isn't it?
Big Red is the biggest selling geranium in the world, and it came originally from America, and it is an engineered plant. What they did is they got an ivy geranium and they mixed it with a zonal geranium. That's the bush geranium. So they've got the ivy mixed with the zonal. And they've produced this wonderful, wonderful plant that is incredibly strong, lives in the most awful conditions quite happily. grows like mad, doesn't get rust, and provides thousands of cuttings if you feed it occasionally. It is an extraordinary plant. Super for pots, great for gardens. I think it's amazing. They've now brought out other bigs. Big Burgundy, we find in our nursery, is a lovely colour, beautiful plant colour. It doesn't, it's not as such a vigorous grower as Big Red, but the other ones we haven't found to be successful, the big pinks and the big splashes, and they do get rust, whereas Big Red and Big Burgundy doesn't seem to be affected by rust so much, but Big Red definitely isn't, because we've done tests on it. We can't make it get can't make it get rust.
Oh, you're so mean. All right, best geranium for hanging baskets we were talking about this morning.
They're the ivy. Obviously, ivy geraniums are ideal for hanging baskets. If you put a zonal geranium, that's the upright geranium, in a pot, they go up. The pot will go stand upright. They use them sometimes in when they've got huge, huge pots. But just for the normal one pots that we use at home, definitely ivy zonal geraniums are going to go stand upright and not sort of, you know, hang down at all. So they're really, ivy geraniums are the ones.
And you've got a beautiful bench of ivy geraniums over there that I'm having a look at. And there is quite of, like, just the most extraordinary colour range of ivies.
Oh, yes, and a lot of new stripy ones, which are lovely. This at the moment, the bench has been picked over by the garden club.
Sorry about that.
there's not so many colours there, but we do have a big range of colours from almost, we've got one that's almost black, and then we've got some really super stripe, what we call stripy ones, you know, sort of dark purple and white and pink and white and red.
Well, because that succulent nature of the ivy leaf geranium, and I'm always trying to make pictures in my pots, particularly with my geraniums. I like to grow them with succulents and ivy leaf geraniums to spill over as a little trifecta. I think they kind of work together.
Yeah, nice idea. I haven't done that, but it does. It sounds very nice.
They've got the same water requirements. So there you get the spillover and then the upright and then the flowering just never stops. I did see a spot, and you just gave me a little cutting, you sweet love, that little cutting of the sweetie. What was it called? Because it
gay
is
gay baby. Gay baby. It's
the cutest thing I've ever seen.
And gay baby apparently was found growing in a garden in Merrylands here in Sydney, I suppose 40, 50 years ago. When I first started being interested in geraniums, gay baby was a really exciting find. It's a very dense growing geranium with a shiny leaf and white flowers. And since then, it's travelled the world, gay baby, and it's been used in breeding as well. And now we've got sugar baby, which is pink, and icing sugar baby, which is white. But they're not quite as dense a grower as gay baby. Gay baby is special. It's different. It's the only one of its type.
It's really sweet and just lovely as a little clump in a little low terracotta pot. I love what you do here at the nursery. I mean, the benches of just thousands of different coloured geraniums are great, but at the front you always have a changing display of geraniums and other odds and sods that are flowering at the same time. It just reminds me that we need to be a bit better at styling our pots a little bit more, you know, grouping things for effect.
Yes, that's right. Our display in the front here drives our customers mad because it's always what they want.
Yeah, and they can't
do it. And so we don't sell it. But no, I've had some fabulous orchids among them this year. I don't grow orchids. I don't know anything about them. But I was given a couple of pots of them, and they've been absolutely extraordinary. And it was just that lemony one. And you know, we don't have a. We do have a yellow geranium, but it's a very, very small little thing, and it's not the sort of thing that's showy. But we had this lovely big yellow lemony orchids among, you know, I put some of the orange and orangey coloured geraniums with it. It's lovely. It's nice to have different things.
Well, because we've all got pots, thousands of pots everywhere, if you know, normal gardeners just, you know, you can't walk down the side passage because of the number of pots. But it just reminds me that we need to sort of edit our pots and pull them out of wherever they are, bring them onto a you know, out the front door, for example, or a lovely old table, and just sort of create a vignette or a little composition with beautiful geraniums, you know, orchids if they're flowering, or succulents look fantastic with them as well because you get that little rosette colour. So, yeah, really great take-home idea. Thank you so much. You inspired the whole Garden Clinic class today with that. I'm really thrilled, and we got through so much information about the care and techniques to do with growing great geraniums and pelargoniums, and I really thank you for taking the time to talk to me.
You're welcome. Nice having your group here.
Yeah, it was really lovely. That cup of tea, slice of cake was fantastic. You're listening to Linda Ross and the Digs Deeper podcast. Plant of the week this week, love them or hate them, wisteria. The one we've seen all over the shop this week is definitely the Chinese form. It's vigorous. It's a quick growing vine. And sometimes I think you need Olympic level training required to kind of contain their exuberant growth and encourage a good shape. I love them when they're a long curtain, but really wisterias can be trained and shaped into any style. You can have like a waterfall shrub, you can have a lollipop standard, you can train them over sturdy pergolas and archways, along fences and verandas, you can frame windows, and also I've seen some beautiful bonsai in Japan. But the key is you need to train them. You can't just let them go. You've got to make them do what you want them to do. And if you've got limited space, wisteria really is quite happy in a pot on a sunny balcony. We've had great success with wisterias in half wine barrels, for example. Get a firm stake and then secure them up the stem, tie them along, remove all the side shoots, and then when the main stem reaches 1 meter or 1.5 meters or however high you want that lollipop to be, cut them off. I've seen some really good lollipop standards in Lions Gate Lodge Garden in the Botanic Gardens in Sydney. They really are spectacular. The Chinese wisteria, which is called Wisteria sinensis, is super common. It's mainly mauve, dark mauve, but there is a darker purple form called amethyst. There's a white form also called alba, and there's a lovely, another nice white one too called Jaco, which is a little bit more strongly scented. So if you don't like that simple purple one, look out for the other cultivars. And if you want a flower that's just a little bit more unusual, a little bit more rare and endangered, why don't you look at the Japanese form of wisteria? The pendulous raceme, the inflorescence, is much longer in the Japanese varieties. They do differ quite a lot. One of the most famous is called Matroboides, also called Wisteria floribunda longissima. Now, longissima obviously is referring to that long, long flower, which can be about 3 foot long, like a meter long, which is amazing. Pale mauve, and very much better on a high pergola when those long inflorescences can actually hang like lace, like lacy curtains. Other varieties I absolutely love in the Japanese wisteria range is a little double one called Violacea plena, plena meaning double. It's so beautiful. Shirinoda is a spectacular pure white form with very long clusters or long inflorescence. Black Dragon's available now, and it's one of the darkest ones. It's also known as Royal Purple. And the racemes on that one's about 40 centimetres. So what's that, about a foot and a half? So much, much longer than your Chinese variety. So there's some really excellent ones. Oh, there's a pale pink one too I better tell you about for all you pink lovers. Honbenai, H-O-N-B-E-N-I. It's a lovely Japanese one, palest pink. And again, grows really well on an arbor or an archway where you can really make the most of its hanging, dripping, lace-like qualities. Now the silky wisteria. This is the Wisteria venusta. It's much less familiar to most of us, and it's one of the sweetest scented wisterias out there. Some lovely Japanese ones. Okayama is gorgeous. I really love that one. Heavily textured flowers, much larger flowers, and a sweeter scent than the Japanese or the Chinese. So look out for some unusual cultivars of wisteria when you're out there looking. Now, wisterias do need that little winter chill to get them flowering really well. But, you know, wisterias have been seen right up to Brisbane and right down to Tasmania. They're not fussy. They're not fussy about the soil. And as long as you keep them well watered after planting, they establish really quick. I like to apply fertilizer in spring and midsummer until the vine's the size you want. And then really, it's not, you don't have to do anything else except to prune and train them where you want them to go. It's really important. Keep in mind that overfeeding actually produces leaves at the expense of flowers. And also keep in mind that pruning later than January will remove the flowering shoots, and therefore flowering come spring will be impeded. So don't prune your wisteria after January, and don't overfeed because you won't get any flowers at all. In fact, it's nice to keep them keen. If your wisteria is near roses and they're getting a lot of that rose food as well, you might not get good flowering on your wisterias as well. Now pruning, when to prune. Tie the new season's shoots onto the required position and remove any unwanted shoots as they appear. Remove the tips of the long shoots until they've reached the required length. And then what you want to do is encourage the development of side shoots. Trim them to the size that you want them to go and train them along what you want them to be trained along. Wires, timber. I think wires is an excellent idea because timber can rot underneath them. They're incredibly long-lived wisteria. In fact, some of the wisteria I saw on my Japanese wisteria tour each May are 400-500 years old, and one of them spanned over an acre in size. That's an acre. That's twice. That's a huge Japanese wisteria. The one that was over an acre, it was the Violacea plena, the double wisteria, very, very dark purple. And the fragrance when I sat underneath that and walked that whole acre with the wisteria perfectly trained above me on bamboo trellis was absolutely one of the most beautiful things I think I've ever seen in my entire life. England's got some great wisterias. Of course, Sissinghurst wisteria, which cascades over those rosy brick walls, is very popular and very popular. I think the best time to visit England is May and early June for the wisteria. Japan, of course, there is a tunnel made of 150 different colours of wisteria, and that's 6 hours from Tokyo, actually, in a garden called Kawachi Fuji. And the funny thing in Japan is Fuji is actually Japanese for wisteria. So a Fuji garden is a wisteria garden, and Kawachi Fuji garden is the place to go to see those really long archways, 200 metres long, planted up with hundreds and hundreds of different varieties of wisteria, pink, lilac, purple. So that is a place to go if you love wisterias as much as me. Now, the garden hack of the week. Well, weather reports say we're not going to get any rain for 3 months and our gardens are dry. Dry as a crisp. We might be getting light rain, but what we really need to do is maximise the rain that falls. So what I'd really like you all to do over your garden beds and pots is apply a wetting agent. The wetting agent I would like you to use is two of the most environmentally friendly wetting agents, either Wetter Soil or Ecohydrate. Ecohydrate's good, and so is Wetter Soil, because they've come in a granule, which means that I can see where I've broadcast it over the garden beds and the soil. And I just make sure that it's evenly broadcasted along all my garden beds before I put the mulch on for the spring summer months. So it's a really perfect job to do now. And what it does, and you can really do an experiment yourself, get a watering can and water your soil before putting the wetting agent on and just see how it beads and runs off the top, because you've got that crusty layer. Apply the wetting agent and then do it again, and you'll see that it all sucks in straight away, and it's really making the most of all that rain. So honestly, the best thing you can do to drought proof your garden right now is to apply a wetting agent. Experts say you should apply it twice, in the spring and then in the autumn. I think that's an excellent idea, particularly if it's a dry. I definitely do it once a year, and I always do it at the end of winter, early spring, and my garden absolutely loves me for it. I take off the old mulch, I sprinkle it all out, I use some blood and bone as well, and maybe a little bit of potash, potassium sulfate, and then I put the old mulch back, and then I top it up with new mulch, and everything's set and forget. I don't have to do another thing until a year later. I hope you've enjoyed the podcast and gleaned some information. If you're enjoying the Garden Clinic Digs Deeper podcast, tell your friends about it. Leave me a review on iTunes and subscribe to the podcast so you get little reminders when I've put one up live, hopefully every Friday. This is Linda Ross. Check out the Facebook page and Instagram, and we can connect there during the week. Happy gardening and go safely.
The best garden in the street.
G'day, Graham Ross here. Now, you all know I love my gardening, and we all know that Sea Sol is simply fantastic for keeping your garden healthy and looking great. But did you know that Sea Sol reduces transplant shock and dramatically increases the plant's survival rate when they're newly planted? Now, look, it's like an insurance policy for your plants. So when you're planting out your seedlings and new plants in your garden, don't just water them in, Sea Sol your plants.
Don't forget the Sea Sol.